is the most important thing about you? This is the interactive portion of the program. What is the most important thing about you? You're saved, Christ in me. Huh? Eternal life. What's that? Created in the image of God. Relationship with God. A.W. Tozer, who was a pastor a couple of generations ago, said, the most important thing about you is what you think about when you hear the word God. What do you think about when you hear the word God? What do you think about? Savior of the world. Holy. What? Salvation. Forgiveness. Love. Sovereign. Truth. Anyone in here thinking about an old man on a cloud? With a long beard. In fact, for some of what you just said there have to do with the attributes of God, but I want you to put the word God aside for just a second. You do realize that that is not his name. God is not his name. It's just a word we use to describe what we mean by the creator and sustainer of all things. In fact, I want you, instead of thinking about the word God, I want you to ask yourself this question. Who is the source and sustainer of all things? Who is the source and sustainer of all things? Well, let's think about who is the source and sustainer of all things. And for most of what we're going to talk about in the next 10 minutes, we don't even need the Bible for. I think that we can reason to this conclusion. We do this in the book Stealing from God, that the source and sustainer of all things has certain attributes. One of the attributes is this source is self-existing. He is the uncaused source of all being. You can't go on an infinite regress of causes. You have to ultimately get back to a cause that has always existed. An uncaused first cause, what Aristotle might call the unmoved mover. There has to be a being who has always existed. This is why it's stupid to ask the question, who made God? Because nobody made the unmade. Nobody created the uncreated. The being that has always existed is what we mean by the source and sustainer of all things. And in the Bible, this being is called the great I am. The being that didn't have a beginning, the being that won't have an end, the being that just bees. Also, this being is infinite, unlimited. We might say completely actualized. What does actualized mean? It means this being has no potential to get better. This being is maxed out, we might say. Another Aristotle word is actualized, completely actualized. You and I are combinations of actuality and potentiality. We can change. We have potential to change. God has no potential. He is completely actualized. This source and sustainer is also simple, meaning undivided in being, not made of parts. We're all made of parts. You have parts, I have parts. The church has parts. Everything that's made has parts. It's composed. If it's composed, someone must have composed you. Somebody put your parts together. But you can't go on an infinite regress of composers. You ultimately are going to get back to an uncomposed composer. A being that isn't composed, is simple, has no parts, has always existed. This being is also spaceless, transcends space. He's not extended into space because he doesn't have matter. He's immaterial, which we'll get to here in a second. This being transcends all space. Timeless, transcends all time, which will also lead into the fact that he knows all things. He doesn't have to wait for things to happen. He knows what's going to happen. He's outside of time. He can see the end from the beginning. We gain knowledge, he is knowledge. This being is also immaterial, spirit, not made of matter. Jesus to the woman at the well, the base of Mount Gerizim, as recorded in John chapter 4, Jesus says to this woman, we must worship the Father in spirit and in truth. This being is spirit. This being is all-powerful, omnipotent. Now, all-powerful doesn't mean that this being can do anything. All-powerful means this being can do anything that's not logically impossible, that doesn't contradict his nature. So this being, for example, can't create a square circle because there's no such thing. He can't create a one-ended stick. He can't create a married bachelor. He can't create an honest politician. There are some things that are just too hard for God. They're impossible, right? But anything that's possible, God can do. This being is also omnipresent. It's everywhere present. That doesn't mean that God is all things. That would be a worldview known as pantheism, like a New Age worldview. You're God, I'm God, we're all God. The tree is God, the podium's God, right? No. That's not what when we say God is everywhere present, we don't mean he is everything. We mean his presence and power is holding all things together. He's holding everything together. His power is present everywhere. He's all-knowing. He's omniscient. He knows the end from the beginning. He is the ground of all truth. Jesus said, I am the truth, and the truth will. What does that imply? If the truth will set you free, it implies that you don't have the truth, you're in bondage. We're all in bondage if we don't have the truth. Bondage to our own sin. Also, immutable. This being is unchangeable. What's he going to change to? If he's a perfect being, any change would necessitate a move from perfection to imperfection. But since this being is perfect, he can't change. He wouldn't be the standard of all truth if he could change from truth to a lie, right? So he's immutable. This being is also personal. He has mind, emotion, and will, and can make choices. In fact, he made a choice to create the universe and create you, which implies that he has the ability to make choices. This being is also holy, set apart, morally perfect. He's the morally perfect standard of love and justice. And you know this intuitively. In fact, Paul says in Romans 2, just pointing out what we know intuitively, that the Gentiles are not of the law written on their hearts. Our Declaration of Independence says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created by their government? No. Created by their creator and endowed with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. You know certain things are right and you know other things are wrong. Why? Because there's a standard outside of ourselves that tells you that murder is wrong and say love is right. If there was no standard beyond ourselves that we're all obligated to obey, then it would just be one person's opinion against another person's opinion. You think murder is wrong, somebody else says, like Hitler, says it's okay. If there's no standard beyond both of you that you're both obligated to obey, then murder's just a matter of opinion. Well, we know it's not just a matter of opinion. There is a standard outside of ourselves that we're obligated to obey. That standard is the source and sustainer of all things. Now, you can reason to every one of these attributes without any Bible. This is called natural theology. Aristotle did this. Aquinas did this. Jefferson knew this. In fact, if someone were to ask you, how do you know God exists? I think what you ought to say is, I know God by his effects. If there's a creation, that's an effect. I'm reasoning back to a cause of creator. If there's design, that's the effect. I'm reasoning back to a cause of designer. If there's a moral law written on my heart, that's the effect. I'm reasoning back to a moral lawgiver. You're always reasoning from effect back to cause. All the effects that you see around you can help you reason back to these attributes. But the last one that we're going to talk about briefly, you need the Bible for. You wouldn't know that God was triune, three persons in one divine essence, unless he revealed it to you in what we call special revelation, the scriptures. We might surmise that there has to be some plurality in God, because if God is a strictly monotheistic being, like, say, Allah, how can Allah be love prior to creation? He couldn't be, because there's no one to love. But in the Trinity, you have a lover, a loved one, and a spirit of love. God is love from all eternity. He doesn't need to create. It's not like he was lonely and he needed us, but he chose to create. In any event, these attributes are the attributes of the source and sustainer of all things. And by the way, if you deny this source exists, you're using attributes of this being to deny it, like logic and reason. He is the ground of all truth, the ground of all reason. If you say, I don't think God exists, you're using reason to say that. You're sawing off the branch upon which you sit. So this being exists, but it's hard to get your mind around attributes like this. God is infinite. The source and sustainer of all things is infinite. Now, it would be strange if an infinite God wasn't strange to us, right? Because while we have some of these attributes in a limited or finite way, it's hard to imagine what these attributes are like in an infinite way. And so how does God, what does he say to us to help us understand who he is? Go to Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. The great prophet who wrote in about the 700s BC. Who is God? What is he like? Isaiah will tell us what God says we should do if we want to learn more about who God is. If we want to learn more about what is God like. Go down to verse 25 in Isaiah chapter 40. Here's what it says. To whom will you compare me, or who is my equal, says the Holy One. In other words, this is God speaking. He's saying, to whom will you compare me? Who is my equal? You want to know what I'm like? Here's what he says. Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name, because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. You want to know what God is like? Look to the heavens. Psalm 19 says essentially the same thing. Look to the heavens. Well, you know what we're going to do here this morning? We're going to look to the heavens. And when we look to the heavens, we're going to see three facts about the heavens. First of all, the heavens are precisely created and designed. Secondly, they're unimaginably vast. You're not going to believe how vast the heavens are. And then we're going to see that the heavens dazzle us with their beauty. The heavens are beautiful, which reflects the nature of God. So what we're going to do is start here at point one. The heavens are precisely created and designed. Are you guys ready to go? How do we know the heavens are designed? Or how do we know they're created and designed? Well, there's something out there known as the Big... Now, I know some of you are going, Frank, you know, we're Christians in here, and we don't believe in the Big Bang. You guys don't believe in the Big Bang? I believe in the Big Bang. I just know who banged it. In fact, the evidence for the Big Bang is so good, the creation event, that even atheistic scientists are admitting it. The late Stephen Hawking said this. He said, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Atheists are admitting that space, time, and matter came into existence out of nothing. Now, in the books that we have back there, we explain why they think this. I don't have time to get into it now. But most atheists will agree, yes, space, time, and matter had a beginning out of nothing. Now, they don't think it's God, but let me ask you a question. What else could create space, time, and matter out of nothing. It can't be something made of space, time, and matter. Why? Because space, time, and matter didn't exist. It must be something that transcends space, time, and matter. In other words, the cause of the universe has to at least be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful to create the universe out of nothing, personal in order to choose to create. Why? To go from a state of nothingness to a state of creation, someone had to make a choice, and only persons can make choices. Also, the cause would also have to be intelligent to have a mind to make a choice. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when you think about a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent cause, who do you think of? God. You say, how do you know it's the Christian God, Frank? We don't. Yet, we don't know if this is the Christian God or Allah or some other theistic or deistic God. You'd have to see if Jesus rose from the dead to discover whether or not this is the Christian God. We'll talk about that tonight. We'll give you evidence that Jesus rose from the dead. But if Jesus did rise from the dead, then we can say that the same being that walked out of the tomb 1,993 years ago is the same being in whose divine nature created the universe out of nothing. We haven't gotten there yet. We haven't seen the evidence yet. All we're saying is this could be the Christian God. It turns out that since Jesus did rise from the dead, it is the Christian God. And we'll see that more tonight. So, the universe certainly was created, but it wasn't just created, it was also designed. And this is an argument that scientists have been using for the past 50 or so years called the fine-tuning argument for the universe. That the universe is so fine-tuned that if you were to change virtually any of the 100 or so parameters about our universe, change any one of them imperceptibly, we don't exist. That the universe is balanced on a razor's edge. Let me just give you a couple of these. And again, from Stephen Hawking, an atheist, he said this. He said, if the expansion rate of the universe was different by one part in 1,000,000,000,000, a second after the Big Bang, the universe would collapse back on itself or never develop galaxies. In other words, if you were to change the expansion rate, that infinitesimal amount at the very beginning, none of us would be here. Now, you can't make any sort of evolutionary argument that, oh, maybe the expansion rate evolved to this point by chance, whatever that means. You can't make that argument. Why? Because the expansion rate didn't change to, by chance, a particular rate. It started from the very beginning exactly where it needed to be. If it were any different, none of us would be here. Now look, that value was either designed or it wasn't. What makes more sense? That it was designed or it wasn't? Somebody designed it. Also, the gravitational force. If it were altered by more than one part in 10 to the 40th power compared to the strong nuclear force, we would not exist. What's one part in 10 to the 40th power? That's one part in one with 40 zeros following it. You say, Frank, I can't get my head around that number. I know, neither can I, so let me give you an illustration. Take the entire North American continent from Central America all the way to Greenland, the 51st state. And stack it in dimes all the way to the moon. That's 238,000 miles. And then do that on a billion other North American continents. Stack them in dimes all the way to the moon. Take all those piles of dimes, the billion piles of dimes, put them in one humongous pile, mark one dime red, mix it in, blindfold a friend, throw them on the pile, tell them to pick one dime at random. The chance you would pick that one marked red dime is one chance in 10 to the 40th power. Is he going to pick that dime? You'd have to be an idiot to bet on that. Of course he's not going to pick that dime. That's the odds of that value being right where it is. Was that value designed or not? It was designed, which means there's a designer. You say, maybe it happened by chance. First of all, ladies and gentlemen, is chance a cause? Does chance cause things? Who caused this? Chance, he was just here. No! Chance is not a cause. Chance is a word we use to describe mathematical possibilities. Chance doesn't cause anything. In fact, you know what scientists mean when they use the word chance? We don't know. Look, it was either designed or it wasn't. I just showed you two of about 100 of these parameters about not only the universe, but our solar system. Change any one of them, we're not here. The universe was created and it was designed. Also, the universe, secondly, is unimaginably vast. We're going to start at our solar system and show you the solar system and some parameters about our solar system on how designed it is and also how vast it is, and then we're going to look at the entire universe. Let's start in our solar system. Here we are, right here. We are third rock from the sun, right there. Do you know that if we were a little bit closer to or a little bit further away, we couldn't survive? A little bit closer to, we'd burn up. A little bit further away, we'd freeze. We are what scientists call the Goldilocks zone. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. It is. That's a lie. It's too hot here in the summer. I've been here. The axial tilt, 23.5 degrees. Change that slightly, we don't exist. Earth rotation, 24 hours. Change that slightly, we don't exist. The size and distance of the moon from us. Change that slightly, we don't exist. If Jupiter was not in its current orbit, we couldn't exist here on Earth. Why not? Because Jupiter's gravitational force is so strong that it attracts most of the meteors and space junk to it rather than us. It's a cosmic vacuum cleaner. In fact, Jupiter's so big, do you see these purple marks here? This is the Earth. These purple marks are comet fragment strikes that are bigger than the Earth. Thank God for Jupiter. Because if Jupiter wasn't there, we wouldn't be here. Saturn does the same thing. Cosmic vacuum cleaner. In fact, you want to see the size of the planets? Here they are. There you go. You got Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Earth. Look at poor Pluto down here. You know, Pluto recently has been demoted as a planet. I don't know about you, but I think it's size discrimination. And what if Pluto identifies as a planet? What then? You bigots. Take a look at this. You can hardly see Pluto. Take a look at this. That's Arcturus. That's another star in our galaxy. Here's the sun. Jupiter is 1 pixel in size on this scale. Earth is invisible. Pluto? Forget about it. All right, keep an eye on Arcturus now. Where's Arcturus now? You see it way over here next to Regal? That's Antares. That's another star in our galaxy. The sun is 1 pixel in size on this scale. Jupiter is invisible. Earth, Pluto, forget about them. In fact, if the Earth was the size of a golf ball, Betelgeuse here. Look, I don't name the stars, all right? If the Earth was the size of a golf ball, Betelgeuse would be 5 or 6 Empire State Buildings high. The heavens are awesome. And this is just inside our galaxy. This is not outside our galaxy. This is inside it. And the average distance between stars in our galaxy is 30 trillion miles. And all that distance is necessary for us to exist here on Earth. If it was a different distance, gravitational forces would cause us to go out of orbit, which means we couldn't live. Now, 30 trillion miles. How far is 30 trillion miles? Far. It'll take you at least 2 tanks of gas and a Toyota Prius to go 30 trillion miles. Now, a number of years ago, my wife and I took our sons, who were small at the time, to the Desert Museum in Tucson, Arizona. If you ever go to Tucson, south of the city. They have this desert museum. It's away from the city lights, so if you go out there at night, you can see thousands of stars on a clear night. So we're out there one night, and it's so clear that the guide we had said, hey, if we look up at 9:03, we will see the space shuttle in orbit. It's like, space shuttle? Remember the space shuttle? You used to go around there? I said, we're not going to see the space shuttle. It's only 400 and... or 100, how long is that thing? 150 feet long? It's like 350 miles up. We're not going to see it. Oh, me of little faith. At 9:03, the guide goes, look! And we look up in the sky, and there's an object streaking across the western desert sky relative to us about like this. I mean, it's really cooking. When it got right about here, it disappeared. I don't know whether Scotty beamed it up or what. Actually, what happened was, despite the fact that we were in total darkness, the space shuttle was so high up that the sun was still reflecting off of it. And then when it got out of the range of the sun, we couldn't see it anymore. Now, when the space shuttle was in orbit, the space shuttle was traveling at about 18,000 miles per hour. That's 5 miles per second. You got trouble getting to work in the morning? Take the space shuttle. You'll be there. 5 miles a second. Think about how fast that is. Well, I did a little calculation to try and figure out how long would it take us if we could get in the space shuttle and go from our star, the sun, to another star an average distance away inside our galaxy, 30 trillion miles. In other words, how long would it take us to go 30 trillion miles if we could go 5 miles per second? How long do you think it would take us? A long time. You must be a math major. No. How long? How much? A million years. Wow, you've the price is right. Higher or lower? I mean... It would take us 201,450 years to go from our star, the sun, to another star an average distance away inside our galaxy. That means if you got in the space shuttle at the time of Christ and started traveling from our star, the sun, to another star an average distance away, you've been going 5 miles a second for 2,000 years, you would be less than 1/100th of the way there right now. And we're going to explore space. No, we're not. We're not going anywhere in space. We can hardly get out of our solar system. Do you know it took 9 years to get to Pluto? I mean, think about this. If the solar system was the size of a quarter with the sun in the middle and Pluto on the outer rim, you know what the next nearest star is? The next nearest star is about 2 football fields away. The heavens are awesome. And this is just in our galaxy. This is not outside our galaxy. This is inside our galaxy. And we're told there are billions of other galaxies. And notice what the psalmist says. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his love for those who fear him. How high are the heavens above the earth? And how many stars are out there? The Hubble Space Telescope helped us discover that. Way back in 2003, they trained the Hubble Space Telescope on 1/26,000,000th of the sky. What's 1/26,000,000th of the sky? Go outside tonight, put a piece of rice on the end of your finger, hold it up at arm's length. That piece of rice represents about 1/26,000,000th of the sky. So they trained Hubble on this little dot in the sky for 11 days of exposure time. What I'm going to show you is what they found. I don't know if you can see the bottom of this slide here. Do you see this down here? These are mountains right here. This is the southern hemisphere. They put together a composite video of what they found. And what I'm going to do is show you the video. It's going to start with the constellations, and then Hubble will zoom out to that one little dot in the sky. This is called Hubble Ultra Deep Field. You can Google this or DuckDuckGo this. Hubble Ultra Deep Field, and you can see this little video. It's in the public domain. There's no audio, just video. You guys ready? All right, here it is. Hubble Ultra Deep Field. There are the constellations. Now let's go see what they found. What you're looking at are nearly 10,000 galaxies in 1/26,000,000th of the sky. Each of these galaxies supposedly have billions of stars of their own. And to go from one star to another star, going 5 miles a second, will take you over 200,000 years. Ladies and gentlemen, I never want to hear any of you ever use the word awesome again, unless you're talking about God or the heavens. Awesome shirt, dude. Awesome shot, dude. Awesome TikTok. No! What word are you going to save for this? How many stars are out there in the whole universe? University of Hawaii researchers had an estimate. Even if they're off by magnitudes, it's still amazing. The number of stars that are out there are about equivalent to the number of grains of sand on all the beaches, on all the earth, times 100,000. And to go from just one star to another star, going 5 miles per second, will take you over 200,000 years. God says, you want to know what I'm like? Look to the heavens. Now, when you look at a universe that has stars equivalent to sand grains on 100,000 Earths, does that make you feel insignificant? It shouldn't. Why? Because as amazing as the heavens are, they're not made in the image of God, but you are. In fact, the heavens were made for you. God didn't have to create, but he chose to create. And he said this, as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his love for those who fear him. When you look at this virtual infinite expanse, you know that God's love exceeds the height of the heavens above the earth for you. Not only is the universe precisely created and designed and is unimaginably vast, this universe dazzles us with God's beauty. I'm going to show you some images from the Hubble Space Telescope. They require no narration. I'm just going to show them to you. He's watching. you really think there's no source and sustainer of all of this? No, you want to know what God is like? Look to his effects. Look to the heavens. They're precisely created in design. They're unimaginably vast. Unimaginably vast. And they dazzle us with their beauty. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what is the most important thing about you? It's what you think about when you hear the word God. God says, you want to know what I'm like? Look to the heavens. What do you see? First of all, you see they're created and designed. You see their universe is unimaginably vast. Stars equivalent to sand grains on 100,000 Earths. Over 200,000 years at 5 miles a second between those stars. Those are just stars. We're not talking about planets. There's more planets than stars. And it's beautiful. But there's a problem. If this is who God is, if we're supposed to get an idea of what God is like by looking at an infinite universe, that means he's infinite in every attribute, including justice. That's bad news for all of us here. Why? Because the God of infinite justice, if he's infinitely just, we're all in trouble. Because we haven't been infinitely just. You know, every college campus I go to, I hear students saying, "We want justice, we want justice." Yeah, keep asking for it. You might just get it. And if you get it, you're not going to like it. But thankfully, in addition to him being infinitely just, he's also infinitely loving. In fact, I only showed you verse 11 from Psalm 103. Let me read Psalm 103, verse 11 and 12. Here it is. "For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his love for those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us." As far as the east is from the east, he's removed our transgressions. How has he removed our transgressions from us? If he's infinitely just, he has to punish us. There's only one way he can avoid punishing us. He has to find an innocent substitute who volunteers to take our punishment upon himself. Where is he going to find an innocent substitute? Not in any one of us. We're all fallen. We've already sinned ourselves. We can't be the innocent substitute. The only way he can find an innocent substitute is to look for him, look to himself. So he adds humanity. He comes to earth. He allows the creatures that rebelled against him to torture and kill him so he could take our punishment upon himself, which means when you trust in him, when you repent of your sins and trust in him, you're not only forgiven, but you're given his righteousness. This is why Jesus is the only way. It's not some arbitrary thing that God says, "Well, look, I just said I'm the only way." No, the only way an infinitely just being cannot punish sin is if he punishes an innocent substitute in our place. That's why Paul says in Romans 3:26 that God remains just and is the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. It's not an arbitrary claim, ladies and gentlemen. There's no way an infinitely just God can do this unless he punishes a substitute. Who is the substitute? Jesus is the substitute. And Jesus proved he was who he was by rising from the dead. And tonight, I'm going to give you some evidence that he rose from the dead. But notice what the writer of Hebrews says about this Jesus. We've been looking to the heavens to get an idea of the majesty of God. But look what the writer of Hebrews says. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. Who is the source and sustainer of all things? Jesus is. And when he came to earth, he took those attributes and put them into human form so we could relate. So you not only look to the heavens, you look to Jesus. And we'll see some of the evidence for this tonight. So when you look to the heavens, what do you see? You see an infinite expanse. Stars equivalent to sand grains on 100,000 Earths, 200,000 years between them at 5 miles a second. You have a being of infinite justice, but also a being of infinite love who created this universe so you could experience his love and you could be reconciled to him. But then there's still a question. Where was this infinite God when my friend was gunned down right next to me? You can see I'm standing right behind him there. We'll talk about that tonight as well. And we'll take your questions.